often men tend to get stuck more in the cerebral. So I have to kind of really help them get past that and help them develop the language part of emotion. For example, things like having them check in with their body is a big thing I do for a lot of guys. Hey, what do you feel in your body right now? Because they could tune into their body. They might say, oh, I feel kind of tight in my chest. Okay, tell me about the tightness. So I sometimes don't even use emotion language in beginning with men. I tend to say, what do you notice in your body right now?
Yeah.
I try to get them in tune, because often men are, you know, if they're detached from their emotions, they also tend to be detached from their body. And so if I get them into their body, it's often an easier access into the emotional state for some men. And women too.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions. Be a part of it for as low as $5 a month and get access to one-on-one coaching with me for as low as $20 a month.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have another dad here on the podcast episode, Therapy for Dads, also known as Travis Goodman. I'm going to let him introduce himself, and then we're going to get started with the conversation. Go ahead, Travis.
Thanks for having me on, Chaz. It's been a pleasure. It's been a night. Speaking of dad stuff, it was a long night a little bit with my little 3-month-old. She took a while to get down. So she went down about 40 minutes ago after being awake for almost 2 hours. And it's about almost 5 a.m. my time. And so it's good morning. I'm waking up. Coffee's starting to kind of come into my bloodstream. And I'm very thankful for that right now. 3 kids. I have a 4.5, although he's probably a little more than 4.5. Well, just for the sake of being easy, 4.5, 2.5-year-old, and a 3.5-month-old. Mm-hmm. So
3 under 5.
We're in a challenging, tiring parenting season with our 2 elder kids, our 4.5 and 2.5-year-old. It's been a long week, I'll just say that. It is what it is. It's that season. So, that's why my wife and I were debriefing last night and just debriefing from the day and the week and, you know, encouraging each other and just listening to one another and validating and just being there for one another from the week. And which is, as you're saying, is super important. And I'm very thankful to have a spouse, a wife that we want to do this together. In my profession, I see the dichotomy I see sometimes often is where I'm seeing couples come into my office, or parents where they don't have that type of relationship with their spouse partner to talk to and get support. It's more conflict, you know, so it's conflict with the kids and conflict with their spouse. And so I'm just like very much. And one thing I love about my job is I'm very much reminded how thankful I am for kind of my wife and our relationship and what we do to put into it and how we work and invest. And how we're able to kind of work through things together and be on a team. So very thankful for her. And so our boys are just, they're in a fun season of toddlerhood.
I kind of want to ask about that a little bit more, because I'm sure there are people out there listening like, man, is he talking about the kind of relationship that I'm in, or what are the common conflicts that you see people coming in, you know, kind of not being on the same page where it's affecting the children, or not, you know, is it not validating each other enough? Is it not, you know, being supportive enough? Like, what is it that you see? What are those kind of common challenges that you see? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, maybe you're thankful to see from the outside to remind you, like, oh man, this is something that's really important that I really need to hone in on. Yeah. Like, what are some of those things so that people out there listening can maybe identify and maybe take steps in a better direction?
Sure. And I think I probably miss this in introing myself because we just jumped in like my kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
My profession, what I do for a living, for my job, is I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. So, I see couples for therapy, couples therapy. I do premarital therapy. I do people coming in when they're having conflict and trying to help them navigate, you know, do individual therapy. And so that's what I do in a day job, you know, full time. And I work in both kind of like a HMO hospital setting as well as a private practice. And so that's what I was referring to, seeing people and hearing their stories and their suffering and their pain and when they get stuck, especially couples. And so with that said, a common thing I see, you know, and I'm very much keep it very succinct for what I see, but a very common issue I see in couples, and often why couples come in to see me, you know, when they're not coming in for like premarital, because like premarital is different. They're like, hey, we want to, you know, we're prepping for marriage. Let's get some tips. I'm not talking about those. Even with those, actually, I do see this when I kind of get into their family history and talk about how they deal with emotions and conflict. And so often I see these things. It's just, we're kind of ahead of the curve versus someone coming in, you know, 10 years of a relationship or a marriage or 15 years, and they've been in conflict for a long time. And now I'm trying to help unravel it and kind of go through. But really, if I could boil it down as I would say, is really missing each other, getting stuck in the kind of secondary defensive emotional states, like frustration, anger, criticism, shutting down, you know, numbing, withdrawing from conflict. So kind of stuck in these kind of non-vulnerable emotions, like, you know, versus coming to your partner from a day, like I'll give a quick example, you know, if I could walk in the door, like last night, let's say after the long day of work, if I came in, my wife and we're talking, and instead of, you know, hearing her and her struggle from the day, I take it personally as if I did something, and I start to get defensive and say, well, you know, why do I this for you? What, you know, why can't you take care of the kids? Why are you so tired? I'm doing all the sacrifice. And I start making it about me and get defensive. And then she starts to get upset and maybe come back, because now I'm attacking. She's coming back at me now and, you know, saying, well, I did this, you know, it's your fault and you should do more. And so we're kind of in this pain, hurt, stress level, and we're talking at this higher kind of, we're not talking about what we really need, but we're kind of stuck in this defensive proving I'm right and, you know, defending ourselves from pain and hurt versus saying, hey, you know, I've had a really rough week and I kind of need your help a little more tonight. My wife saying, and me saying, yeah, I get it. It's been a rough week. And man, I'm so sorry. It's been so difficult for you and stressful. So I'm kind of going, we're going deeper and we're kind of hearing each other. And we're getting to a place where we can be vulnerable and open up about deeper needs, deeper feelings, and on the same team. And so, you know, as that example, what I often hear with couples is they're missing the need. They're not able to have that deeper conversation for various reasons. And I could expand on that more if you would like, but that's really what I tend to see at the end of the day, is people stuck in their hurt, their fear, their, you know, their worries, their concerns. And that tends to drive them versus being able to feel safe in that relationship, opening up and being vulnerable, inviting their partner into the conversation as the team, risking the vulnerability of being heard and seen for who they are in that moment. And then having that kind of have that reciprocal relationship. So that's really the, most boils down to it. You know, obviously take out those extremes of, you know, if there's any abuse of things happening, like obviously those things happen too, but I'm talking in general. In general, that's what I tend to see. And, you know, the outliers are, there's some, you know, significant abuse going on or something else. And those are different. Those are different things. But, you know, or someone has sometimes severe mental illness and they're married to someone, you know, maybe someone's got bipolar disorder and they've had a state. And so sometimes those things are different. I got to help coach them differently when we're dealing with that. But take those out. Your typical run of the mill couple. Is that's where they get stuck.
So, you know, think, I know that a lot of people weren't really raised to express their emotions, to talk about emotions, to be vulnerable, to get to that deeper thing. We have kind of always, most of us have been raised with just, you know, even like a focus on kind of surface level behavior, judgment and criticism. And that is the way that largely, parents communicate to children and their family systems. And so 100%. How do you, you know, go into this kind of new relationship with these, this whole bag of skills that you're talking about, and be successful? Like, how do you do that for the first, like, what if you're a person who kind of maybe grew up like that, you know, like they may be, I'm sure there are definitely some of them listening right now. And maybe they want to get, like, they recognize, they're at the point where they're aware that talking about emotions, being vulnerable and not getting defensive is something that they struggle with, but they don't know how to break through that. Like, what do you suggest that they do? Like, what's the next step after kind of awareness?
Great question. And just to kind of, I guess, to validate your point, my brain's still trying to wake up this morning. But essentially second your point that you're 100% correct. In fact, I've been making some content lately around that exact topic of our emotions. I've been making some reels around that topic for the past week or two, kind of like hitting that. That's kind of been the theme I've been creating and lately. And I've been watching you and you've been doing specifically some of that more too. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I think because we had a conversation last week and some of the stuff came up in our conversation last week, and I've been kind of on that kick. It's like, oh yeah, this is important stuff. And
yeah,
I mean, really hitting on this and teaching. And so I think the reality is this, is that our blueprint for love, our blueprint for emotional language, our blueprint for how we navigate conflict, it all comes from our childhood. So part of my training too is I'm big on attachment focused. I'm an attachment focused therapist. Now, I'm based on the science of attachment, not attachment parenting, which is very different. It's very different. In fact, the person who came with attachment parenting kind of stole the name attachment and used it for his purposes, that, you know, and it's very different than the science of attachment. It's really the science of attachment. You might have done this on your show before. I haven't listened to every episode, but the science of attachment really states it's all about, you know, parents creating a secure, safe base for their children, which therefore enables the child to feel secure and to become more independent to explore the world. And the child knows and can depend and rely on the parent to be there for their emotional, their physical and mental well needs, or even spiritual needs. And it creates this kind of mutual interdependence where it's a healthy dependence on parents as well as a healthy exploration of the world, therefore developing what's called a secure attachment. And also people who have a secure attachment are able to, as they become older as an adult, they can have a very clear narrative and ordered narrative of their life. And they could very clearly state that narrative. And there's not these big gaps. And they remember that parents were there for them for the most part. Like, and it's not about parents needing to be perfect, because no parent's perfect. You're going to miss your kid often. But it's more about, in general, for the most part, my parents were responsive to me. They were there to me. You know, they were present. We could talk about emotions. I didn't feel like, you know, shut down. So with that said, though, most people, though, or a lot of people that I see that come in my office, a majority of them, I would say, might have had a small amount of that, but more often than not, they had what we call more of an anxious or an avoidant attachment style. And that often comes from their environment, from their parents or whoever their caregiver was, where maybe, for example, the parent wasn't responsive or predictable. And so let's say they weren't predictable. Let's say the parent would one day scream at their kid, next day would be super comforting, next day scream at their kid, you know, or be critical of their kid. What that can create is what's called, and I'm very much generalizing here, often will create an anxious style. Therefore, the kid feels anxious all the time. I don't know what I'm going to get from my parent. Are they going to yell at me? Are they going to scream at me? And so it creates this kind of internal sense of anxiety. And often this child, as they become older into adolescence and adulthood, they tend to, in relationships, specifically romantic relationships, tend to feel that anxiety. And it can often manifest in often asking for reassurance. Do you love me? Do you like me? And almost like overly checking that, not trusting that they're lovable or likable. And sometimes they tend to struggle with their own identity, feeling I'm not enough or I'm worthless. And they feel like they have to prove themselves. And then, you know, and obviously in relationships, what that could happen with the partner is their partner can feel that anxiety. Like, and sometimes it might become annoying because like, I've told you I love you, but they're like, I need to prove. It can even manifest in their sexual relationship too, where sex becomes about reducing anxiety, feeling, oh, I'm loved, you know, I feel loved and calm because you love me in this way. So it could manifest in a multitude of areas, it can manifest in a multitude of ways. And then on the flip side, let's say there was a lack of emotional attunement in your home where there was no emotions. It was just like a void. Often what can happen is a kid could come with an avoidance style, meaning it's a numbing, a sort of a super suppression of emotion where it's almost like emotions don't exist. There's no emotional language. It's all logic. It's all head. And so it kind of suppresses this capacity to even know. And so often when you see them in relationships, when there's conflict or some disconnect between their partner and romantic, they'll tend to pull away. They'll disconnect, whether emotionally or sometimes physically, they'll just kind of walk away. And both of them, what they're trying to do, both whether you're anxious or avoidant, it's a different side of the same coin, but they're trying to resolve the conflict in a different way. One is by pulling away by, I don't want to make it worse because maybe my home, it was a less, you know, maybe alcoholic dad, or maybe there was just a void of emotion. So how we dealt with this was just, we don't talk about it. I went to my room and I just waited till things settled down, you know? And so those things is what I tend to see in my office when people are struggling, because the way they're dealing with it, whether that avoidant or anxious style, is still not, it's kind of stuck, because then they deal with it by avoiding or by being critical. And so it creates this new cycle we call, and I've been trained in something called EFT, emotion focused therapy, by Sue Johnson up in Canada. It's a style of therapy for couples, emotionally focused couples therapy. And there's a good book I'd recommend couples reading called Hold Me Tight, which is a great book by Sue Johnson, which is kind of all about this and how they can help identify their negative cycle. And essentially, what it is we get stuck in these patterns, this kind of negative cycle, she calls it, or negative dance, where we, you know, a classic example would be a male partner is the withdrawer and the female is called the pursuer. Another way of saying it, the male partner is the avoider, the female partner is the anxious style. Very, very classic. It's not always that way, but actually it's the most common kind of insecure attachment that you see in a couple. Men tend to avoid, women tend to be the more anxious, critical type. That's not to say it's not reversed. I've seen it plenty of times reversed, but more often than not, that's it. And so what happens is couples get stuck in this kind of, from the example I gave earlier with my wife, like if I came in and my wife was critical at me because maybe I forgot, you know, I didn't help her out. And so she's upset with me and it's coming out in this kind of criticism. I take that And then I get defensive and then I start to pull away emotionally. And the more I pull away emotionally, because I'm trying to not make it worse, she's like, wait a second, hold on. I need you here. Her alarm bell's off. So she gets louder, might get more critical, might even raise her voice because she's like, I need you in this, but she's anxious and feeling upset. And that's the way she's dealt with it her whole life. And as, and how I've dealt with it is I just get farther and farther away. The louder she gets, I realize, oh, I need to be quiet, quiet, quiet. And I get farther and farther away. So it kind of, we kind of ramp each other up until we feel disconnected, more disconnected. And then we get stuck in this cycle, this pattern. And so this cycle, this negative cycle really takes over the relationship. And what happens to couples is they don't, that they're doing what they know to do. This is what they've always done. This is their blueprint. This is how they've managed distress and conflict since childhood or adolescence. And why would they do anything different? This is just how it is. And then we get, and then what happens is we then start to look at the, our partner's behavior and say, well, it's because they're critical or it's because you're pulling away, which, okay, yes, that's, there's a partial truth that when I have them come in. And so part of my job when couples come into my office is I want them to see, okay, here's how you deal with conflict. So why? And I go back to their childhood. Tell me why you think you do that. And then they tell the narrative. It's important because then their partner gets to hear the story, this kind of narrative, which started before their marriage or their relationship. And then vice versa. Okay, you tell me now, partner B, what was it like in your home? Emotions and conflict. And then they get to hear each other's story kind of before they met each other. And then what's happening is I'm helping them connect the dots and to validate, I validate what's going on for them. And I help them go underneath to what's really going on. Some unmet attachment need, we call it. What's really going on? And often what's going on is, and you see this in children, is, you know, I want to be seen. I want to be heard. I want to be validated. I'm scared. I'm nervous. I'm exhausted. I'm overwhelmed. I'm feeling not enough. I'm, you know, it's some unmet, deep, vulnerable attachment need. But if you don't know how to talk about that, if you don't have language for that, even for yourself, you're not going to be able to verbalize that. And that's why it tends to come out as criticism or pulling away because there's no roadmap, no blueprint. It's like we're trying to talk about the second story of a home, but we never built the first floor.
Right, right.
So we have to go back and rebuild the foundation and first floor to then be able to go to that second story, which is very much like kids. And I'm kind of pulling an analogy from Dan Siegel and Tina Bryson from Whole Brain Child, which is a great analogy. But anyway, hopefully that answers your question. A long answer.
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds like that kind of retelling the narrative and kind of getting that out in the open for both people to hear, so that they can both feel seen, so that there's more, maybe more of an opportunity to validate and hear each other's sides and authentically show up, actually seeing the other person.
Yeah.
The way to start to kind of break those negative cycles is just becoming aware of it, that it's happening enough. Is that just the first story of awareness? Like, how do you actually get the skills then? So, because I'm still in this situation, I'm aware that this is, I have a tendency to be anxiously attached or avoidant. I'm aware of it, but like you said, there's no other blueprint. There's no other roadmap. I've identified where the path that I normally take, but how do I veer off and create which, you know, feels like almost kind of with the machete and kind of make a new path that you've never taken or seen. And probably seems like uncharted territory.
Yeah.
How do you actually step into that and actually gain those skills?
A couple ways. One, and I'm going to use a very much a psychological term. You probably heard this, but part of my job is
we'll do that and then explain it.
I'll explain it in a couple other practical ways too. But essentially in therapy, a big part of, at least from how I've been trained and kind of my alignment with being a therapist is very much that, again, that attachment focused piece. And really what attachment focused is very much it's client driven. It's very much trying to be attuned with the client and meeting them where they are. And really what that is if you take the attachment piece, in short, it's providing a corrective emotional experience. So what the hell does that mean? Essentially, providing a corrective emotional experience is when they're in my office, when I'm hearing the, whether it's an individual person I'm seeing for individual therapy, or a couple or family, you know, obviously awareness is most important. Like you said, we have to first bring an awareness to it. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to help. But once they have the awareness of like something, okay, this kind of makes sense. I'm always modeling really that kind of secure attunement by how my body language, my facial expressions, my tone of voice, when they talk, I'm modeling, validating their emotion. You know, it sounds like you're feeling very frustrated or overwhelmed. So I'm part of what I'm doing is actually doing the very thing that they need. I'm becoming that secure base, because there's this thing in attachment science that you could essentially learn or gain secure attachment now as an adult. So you're not stuck, right? You're not just stuck in this. Not like, oh, you're stuck for life. It's yeah. No, you could actually heal. That's the beautiful part. You could heal the wounds from the past and create and learn. And that's the beautiful thing about the brain, is we could heal the brain. And we could retrain and create new neural pathways like this by me modeling. So often every session, I'm modeling this very thing that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And for some people, I might've been the very first secure base in their entire life. Some people though, they may have had some people scattered, like a teacher, maybe an uncle or a grandparent or someone kind of extended to their family, that maybe there was some like glimpse of kind of this happening. But it wasn't consistent, because, you know, a teacher they haven't, but they were like, oh, I remember this teacher who, man, they really listened to me. That felt so amazing. So they have like, sometimes like a, that's what that was, what I was looking for. Yeah. And I'll find that a lot too, you know, through a teacher or like a coach or something, where I could kind of say, hey, yeah, that's what's happening. That's what you needed. And so I'm modeling. And then sometimes I give reading, you know, on the practical level too, on top of modeling, because I think part of that corrective emotional experience is we learn powerfully through feeling. Book knowledge is helpful for some people, and a lot of people, it's helpful to read and I think understand, but if it's just cerebral, it's not enough for anybody, because we're not just cerebral beings, we're emotional beings. And so that's why in session, I'm modeling it over and over and over and over and over and over again, until it becomes to be, I'm kind of training, practicing with them. And over time, it's like it's kind of like this Jedi mind trick. Cause I don't tell them I'm doing this in the beginning. Yeah. I eventually say that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Cause I don't want them to be so aware of what I'm doing. I mean,
right.
You know, I just want them just to experience it. But eventually I say, this is actually what I'm doing. But I'm giving that emotional, I'm trying to tune into their emotions without kind of bypassing the cerebral. And some people, like often men, tend to get stuck more in the cerebral. So I have to kind of really help them get past that and help them develop the language part of emotion. For example, things like having them check in with their body is a big thing I do for a lot of guys. Hey, what do you feel in your body right now? Because they could tune into their body. They might say, oh, I feel kind of tight in my chest. Okay, tell me about the tightness. So I sometimes don't even use emotion language in beginning with men. I tend to say, what do you notice in your body right now?
Yeah.
I try to get them in tune, because often men are, you know, if they're detached from their emotions, they also tend to be detached from their body. And so if I get them into their body, it's often an easier access into the emotional state for some men, and women too. But it's just another avenue to get in. So I help them kind of develop that language and practice it. I go slow with them. And there are books I will recommend reading, because it just kind of helps kind of continue to align with some of the knowledge and psychoeducation along with the experiential. It's kind of, I'm giving them both.
Yeah.
But I do know without the experiential, I would say in my experience, most people, it doesn't really heal as much. Yeah. You need that experience. You need the feeling, you need the in vivo, validation to actually know, because we learn through, as kids, through experience and watching and observing. Yeah. And we're not learning really through we're not watching a book happen in front of us.
Right.
We're feeling the emotional states of our environment.
Yeah.
We're picking up the energy.
Yeah. Yeah. And the language that we use is powerful amongst each other, and especially amongst and around children. And, you know, that same thing, you're modeling the language and giving them the experience of what it's like to be seen and heard and validated, right, and to understand the emotional message behind what they're saying or trying to communicate. That is something that, you know, I just heard you say, like, that is one of the most powerful ways to teach this to adults, but it's also one of the most powerful ways to teach it to children, right, too. And if we can teach it to children young, then there's less healing that has to be done later, right, on. It's just their environment. It is just their norm of how they speak and talk about emotions and are connected to their sensations in their body and all of those things. And something I say when people kind of like are a little skeptical about the power of modeling language and using this language is, you know, go to the next birthday party you go to, if you're a parent, or if you're a teacher, next time you go into classroom, go in and drop the F-bomb. Drop the SH bomb and see if they don't start to catch on, they don't start to, you know, understand and use that language if you're using it over and over again. And I'm just kidding, don't actually do that. But the point is that we're so aware of like the language that we use when it's like bad language or curse words using it around children, because we're aware, at least on some level, that children absorb the language that we use around them. And so we don't want them to use that language. So a lot of people won't use that language around children. But the same goes for more positive, healthier language, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Emotions, right?
Yeah.
And so it's that same power, but we're not as aware. We don't talk about enough. We're not as cognizant of the impact of the positive language that we can use around children, how they can adopt that as well.
Totally.
So I think what you're saying is really powerful. And I actually want to go into your, speaking of dads, your Instagram handle, by the way, for anyone listening, who stayed this far, his Instagram handles Therapy for Dads. Mm-hmm. And I want you to kind of tell me a little bit about like what that is and kind of like why, like, you started that, and, you know, what are you doing and why are you doing it?
Sure. Real quick before I go there,
okay,
again, about the whole, couples coming in and the emotions. Something else I've discovered just being a therapist is, and my training and experience is, some of this too, some of people's emotional reactions as well is, yes, from that insecure style, avoidant, you know, anxious style from their parenthood, but also for some, there's also some significant trauma, emotional trauma, relational trauma, sometimes like physical sexual abuse trauma. Like, there's things sometimes too that are other layers to people's reaction, why they can be so sometimes reactive and not know and get so stuck. Like, and so if there's a part of my job too, is that, okay, is there a trauma? Because if I don't also resolve that trauma and heal, that will always keep them kind of a hyper-vigilant, fight-or-flight-freeze state more easily. Because we can all get in that state, fight-flight-freeze. It's just part of being human. In fact, it's a good thing. It's part of our amygdala and survival mechanism. However, if it's always activated,
right,
or more easily activated, you know, you'll never, it's going to be really hard to get to that deeper, vulnerable state, because you're going to be always in self-protection, survival mode.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes too, my job is to, am I dealing with unresolved trauma? And what kind of trauma? Because trauma, you know, is a big topic, and there's various forms of trauma. But I just wanted to mention that too, that it's also a big piece of what I do is healing trauma and looking at is that what we're dealing with here? Is that causing a block as well for this individual to go to that deeper place? So just wanted to say that.
Yeah, it's not always the parents, it's also other experiences that they have in their
absolutely
life and the mm-hmm environment and culture, yeah, and all that stuff.
Right. Yes. Not just parents. I mean, parents are a big one. That's the building block, but there's so many other influences, your environment, there's culture, there's, you know, other romantic relationships, people you dated, friendships. I mean, yeah, I say parents and whoever raised you because that's the core, but there's other things that,
yeah,
add to that. You know, you could, for some people I know, they could have a totally great, secure home.
Yeah.
But then something significant happened with a romantic relationship that for whatever reason just shook them to their core.
Yeah.
And then that became a big marker and change. And that became, it could have been a big trauma, you know? And so, you know, or there was an abuse happened. They got an assault or something happened and there's a shift. So definitely part of my job is to kind of unpack that with them and say, what am I really dealing with here? Because again, if I don't resolve that, they'll pretty much always stay stuck until we heal that piece.
Okay. And I got to ask, I know I had another question, but I'm just thinking about the person, the parent out there that is thinking, oh no, like I'm starting to lose control here. Like other things in the environment, how do I like protect, how do I protect my child against the things in their environment? You know, and I hear things like school, friends, like how do I, you know, what do I do as a parent so that they don't have to do as much healing? You know, I'm trying to do every, like, what, yeah, what is that?
I guess in a short answer, one, know your story as a parent. A good book on that's called Parenting from the Inside Out by Dan Siegel.
Yeah.
He's a neuropsychologist. It's great work. But great book on just like self-reflective work and, why you parent the way you parent. So know your story, know your stuff, know where your strengths and part of your healing needs to happen. If so, and then number two, for the most part, showing up and being present with your kids and validating them at the most basic level. I mean, we can go into more nuance, but I think, yeah, at the most basic level, being there for your kids, because right, the reality is you can't protect them from everything. In fact, part of their job is to, you're supposed to be that safe haven, the bulwark them, to be back for them to process, to help, yeah, equip them to go back out, because you can't be there in every situation. You have to let that go.
Yeah.
You have to let them deal with that. But your job, you are that safe, mm-hmm, you are that safe haven, that safe base, that home base for them to come back to and to listen. Start with listening. Start, yeah, with just validating. Don't try and fix it. Just listen. Yeah. You know, and even for dads, you don't gotta, I mean, most men, and this is in general, men want to fix things right away.
Yeah.
Which is good. Nothing wrong with fixing. Often though, when it comes to emotional experiences, the fix often is listening and just validating and being present and sitting and hugging and just being in that space with their children.
Yeah.
And often that is the fix, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes we need to have a fix later, but start with listening, validating, being that safe base. Because, yeah, it allows your kid to know, oh, I can talk about whatever I need to with my parent. I can come home and,
yeah,
they'll listen to me versus, you know, I can't talk to my parents about it.
Yeah.
You know, they don't listen.
They do have like a trauma or a tough experience that they're able to come back. They feel safe enough to go to you,
yeah,
and have that open communication and process that trauma so they're not alone in it and dealing with it internally and maybe in unhealthy ways or,
right,
or dealing with it the way that they see their peers dealing with it, which also, right, may be from their kind of unhealthy patterns that they,
yeah,
have picked up somewhere.
Yeah. And if it's hard for you as a parent, if it's hard, this is the reflective piece. Why is it difficult for you? What about it is difficult to be present? Because, yeah, often that's an indicator that maybe no one was present for you and you didn't have someone present. So it's kind of that, it's that pay attention to your emotional reaction, your thought reaction when your kid is struggling. You know, it's just, these are just paying attention to your experience because you can grow and heal too as your kids are healing. Like if you're stuck, yeah, in something, that's the beautiful thing, is you can keep growing as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So, all right. Therapy for dads.
Therapy for dads. Yeah.
What is it? Why do you do it? Talk, yeah, to me.
So, it's evolved a bit since its initial conception, but it initially came from my personal experience as well as my experience working with men in therapy. And then more specifically on top of that, dads. So quick story. Essentially, our first kid coming pregnant, it took about 6 years to get pregnant with our first kid. It wasn't easy for us. We had to go through infertility things. And that was just a journey for us, my wife and I. And initially, early on when it happened, we weren't talking about it until one day my wife came to me and kind of broke down. And I didn't realize how much this was affecting her. This is probably in the first year we're trying to get pregnant, you know, and I wasn't thinking about the pregnancy tests. Like, oh, it's just going to happen, you know, happen when it happens. And then she kind of told me what was really going on for her. And it kind of really opened up my eyes for the first time. Like, oh, I had no idea this was this hard. And then I started hearing her story and why it was so hard for her. And even for me, I was like, yeah, this is kind of weird. Cause you just think you get pregnant. Like, that's just what happens. That's just what we're told. Like, oh, you just get pregnant. Yeah, that wasn't our story. But then we start seeing people around us, like they're just getting pregnant. And it's like, why is it so hard for us? But then we start talking and we start talking with other people and we realize, oh, this is more common than not. But initially you don't think that, you just think there's something wrong. Like, what the heck? Cause you don't hear a lot of these stories of people talking about their struggle. It's just, you just get pregnant. You just have kids. This is just, you know, that's what happens. You get married, you have a kid, or, you know, this is the phases of life. And this is how, or even from a young child, it's like, you get married, you have a kid, you have this, you have a house, you have, you know, these narratives that are given to us, you know, we won't talk about that. But anyway, we started realizing, and I realized the power of sharing stories and getting support. And I was in grad school at the time as well. So going through grad school and learning about more about therapy and my story and understanding how this works. And so it was kind of like what I was learning in school, I was dealing with, and at the same time and kind of processing it. And so we started sharing our stories. The more I shared, though, I realized, and then when I started working with men in therapy, that a lot of men don't talk about what they're feeling. A lot of men and dads aren't asked about their, for example, specifically their infertility journey. A lot of women are, which is great. And I'm so glad there's so much support for women. And in general, there's just more of that out there. And there's various reasons, because I think, you know, women have been more socialized to talk about emotions in general. It's been more accepted. There's cultural things in there too, but there's a lot of support for women, not a lot for dads. And I wanted to give dads a voice to share their difficult experiences, because I think there's power in our stories and healing in our stories as we share. It gives hope and healing to others. It validates others. It helps others feel not so alone in their journey, even if it's a different struggle. And so I wanted to give a voice to men and fathers, and ask the question, just ask them and provide space for them to share. So that's initially where it stemmed from, was trying to provide a safe space for them to share their struggles, you know, their stories, whether it was with infertility or some other struggle, a mental health struggle, just anything that men weren't asked directly about. And trying to normalize that conversation, and make it just an invitation and a safe invitation. And that's initially where it came from. And then I started the podcast all around that, as well, Therapy for Dads podcast, really to have those conversations, just to invite them to tell us about a difficulty you've gone through as a dad, you know, mental health, just kind of inviting these dialogues. And since then, it's evolved a bit where I'm still doing that, but now I'm kind of focusing too more on just trying to normalize other mental health things, other, you know, emotional things, like trying to teach about why we have these emotions and why we don't, why we struggle. And so also psychoeducation. So it's really evolved into other things of trying to normalize these things, make it accessible, make mental health, make talking of emotions, giving it in kind of bite-sized pieces to kind of chew on, to ask basic questions for them to wonder. And the stuff I do too, is not, my focus is on men, but it applies to women too at the end of the day. I mean, there's maybe some unique experiences for men versus women, but in general, the stuff I'm doing, it applies to women too. It applies to their experience. I'm just kind of more trying to focus on the men's perspective, and trying to normalize it for them, you know, being a guy, trying to also give a face, for another guy talking about this, who's also trained. So yes, I'm a dad, but I'm also a trained therapist. So trying to kind of normalize that too, that I also struggle, even if I'm a therapist, I also have things I got to work through, even if I'm a therapist. So trying to normalize that too, of like, hey, therapists are real people and they're, you know, they're going through it as well. So yeah, the heart passion behind it is just to help men, to help dads, to equip them, to normalize this stuff, to hear their stories, and to kind of build this community of support. And because that's another big thing, is I found a lot of men don't have a community. They tend to be lone wolves and isolationists. They tend to, you know, the classic, like, just bear it, you know, just pick yourself up by your bootstraps. Don't talk about it. Do it alone. You know, and so part of what I'm doing is also trying to come straight up against the negative narrative of that men deal with, that kind of, you know, don't be vulnerable, do it by yourself. You're weak if you have to rely on, but you know, that classic stuff we hear, it's still prevalent today.
For sure.
It's still some, I mean, we think it's over. It's not over. Yeah. I mean, most men I talk to still talk about that. Yeah. I don't feel like I talk to people. I feel like I'm a weak if I talk about emotions. I feel like I can't be vulnerable. I feel that's been a narrative for a long time and still is a narrative to this day that men struggle with, and women too. To some, absolutely, women struggle with this. For sure. And so I want to create a community. And part of now what I'm doing is evolving is, you know, I had you on the pod last week, and I'm inviting other people in with other expertise and experiences to help, just on top of dads, just other people that can speak to men's experience or emotions or that mental health piece, you know, just to give more just community building, to say, hey, we're all trying to help each other. And how do we build a strong, relational, safe, supportive community to heal, to work through this together from different perspectives? And what I've loved about this journey so far is I've got to meet incredible people all over the world that really have a similar heart and passion, with different backgrounds. You know, like yourself, being able to talk to you, and knowing your heart and your passion and where that stemmed from your story and your childhood and why you do what you do. It's like, you're not a dad right now. Okay. You're a man, and you have your experience as a man and dealing with this stuff. And that's important to hear. And it's building community and relationship to, like, how do we just help change that narrative? How do we change, and not wait for other people to do it? You know, I'm tired of waiting for politics to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, let's evoke change now and then wait for that to catch up. I don't want to wait for this. Like, it's not going to get done. We got to do change now in the small places that we have power and influence, and then evoke change on the bigger, grander scale.
Yeah. So 100% agree with that. now we got to close this out. Running out of time. Wish we had a little bit more time to talk, but I think maybe it'd be good in terms of talking about community to close this out with you telling us how people can get connected with Therapy for Dads if they want to join the community. How do they get connected to that? And then tell us any last words you want us, and then we'll end the recording.
Yeah. So to find me, obviously on Instagram, Therapy for Dads. It's the number 4, not FOR, but Therapy for Dads. I also have a website, therapyfordads.com. You can get on, you could sign up for like a newsletter and kind of email list, and I can send you some information. Podcast, Therapy for Dads. And on Instagram and the website, I have other links. I have a YouTube channel that I run. I do a little more longer form content on mental health videos I've created. Specifically more mental health videos, like educational videos on my YouTube channel, which that's just, if you just type in Travis Goodman on YouTube, you should be able to find me. In fact, I think it's youtube.com/Travis Goodman. I'll send you all that information to you. And just join the community and support, whether you could be a mom, a woman, your kid, teen, this is for everybody. I think everyone, and I think it would be helpful if you join it, because you might see a story that you hear and like, gosh, that sounds like my partner. Like, I didn't know that he was going through this. You know, it might just help even give you, if you're, you know, a wife or a female, like, to hear a men's perspective of like, wow, I had no idea that they can go through this. And maybe I could share this with my friends, you know, because I think of my dad, or I think of my partner, I think of my brother, I think of, it's just to help and to share these stories if it speaks to you, and to just broaden this to build this community of support. And that's how to find me. And I'd love to have you on. If you have questions, ask me. I'd love to talk to you and, you know, direct message me or whatnot, or email me through the website, and more than happy to talk to you and, you know, have a conversation and share, and maybe even have you on the pod if you got something that you think would be important to share and or interview you. And I'm looking to build, just continue to build this community and relationship, because it really is through, I firmly believe this, healing comes through not isolation. Healing comes through relationship and community. We are built and wired for relationship. That's our hardwired, is to be in safe relationship. And that's how we heal, is in safe relationship. We don't heal in isolation. We stay stuck. We need each other. So that's why I want this. That's why I want to continue building this, because there's power in relationships. There's healing that comes. And it's amazing to see when I see people heal. It is the most wonderful gift to see as a therapist, as a person, to see people, to see that healing take place and to see them live freer lives, more fulfilled lives, and calmer lives, more peaceful lives, and to not be stuck and bound by their past fears, their shame, their hurt, their traumas. Like, because then they get to pass it down to their kids of the next generation. Like what you're trying to do is you're trying to break those generational, those things that keep us stuck and stop it now, so their kids have less healing to do. The reality is we're going to have to heal from something to some degree. But if we can take away some of the big stuff and equip them more, the next generation, because then the next generation has more, and the next generation has more, and the next generation has more. It's like, man, what a wonderful gift, legacy to give away. And that's what I'm trying to do.
What's my name? What's my name? What's